from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
As President Trump addressed the United Nations last month, observers wondered whether those were the words of a madman, a danger to society, or a stone-cold strategist. We discuss how mental health professionals are assessing the president's psychological state and the ethics and politics involved. It's coming up next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Ever since President Trump announced his candidacy, journalists, armchair therapists, and mental health professionals have posited theories about his psychological state. The Republican head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker, has warned that President Trump, quote, has not been able to demonstrate the stability nor some of the competence necessary for a successful presidency. Corker doubled down on those comments earlier today, and to some, Trump is dangerous, pathological narcissist, and to others, his unpredictability is one of the keys to his success. A new book of essays called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump presents the work of 27 psychiatrists and psychologists who have assessed the mental state of the president. In this hour, we're joined by psychiatrists and contributors to the book, and we're going to discuss the science, politics, and ethics of evaluating President Trump's psyche. Joining me first is Robert Lifton, who is a contributor to the book and wrote the foreword, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. He's also now a lecturer in psychiatry at Columbia University, author of more than 20 books about the effects of war, terrorism, and genocide. And his latest book is The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival. And Robert Lifton, pleased to have you with us on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I guess we begin with your involvement in this with a letter that you and Judith Herman wrote to the New York Times, essentially questioning just how capable or how competent President Trump is.
Yes, we wrote that letter last March, and we said that we believe Trump to be unfit for the presidency, and we gave two very central reasons. One had to do with his relationship to reality, which is based entirely on his own self, reading the world through his self. And the second had to do with his capacity, or lack of it, to cope with crisis. That was, in a way, my initial foray into the Duty to Warn movement, and it was together with Judith Herman, who had done some things before that.
And this mention of the self, particularly, I wanted to focus on, because we have kind of a new diagnosis that has emerged, and I know that there is a lot of controversy over whether you're trying to be diagnostic about President Trump. Is it classical narcissism? Is it something that goes deeper than that? You know, there's been talk about all sorts of reasons, at least in terms of psychiatric perceptions. But the word solipsism has come into this lexicon.
That was my word, I think. At least I brought it in one interview I had with Bill Moyers. By solipsistic reality, what I mean is that he can only perceive information through his sense of self and by means of what his self requires. That means he can be cut off from larger principles and empathy for others. It's a very dangerous trend in a president. I don't believe he's psychotic in the sense of losing his mind, but with this particular approach, it affects everything he does cognitively, everything he thinks or says, and that's why he can speak of things that are totally false, can partly believe in them, and maybe partly not. And that's what I call solipsistic reality. It resembles narcissism, but narcissism is more self-love, and solipsism is more ideas and ideation, cognitive.
Now, solipsism simply means there's no reality beyond the subjective reality, but this is a kind of identification of a malignant solipsism, isn't it?
Yes, it's very malignant because there's nothing beyond it that is a source of information for him. And when you think of that, that's a very radical and dangerous situation. And it's combined with, as many of the writers of this book say, a paranoid tendency, a sense that he's being victimized and has to strike back.
Now, the writers of this book, the writers who are included in this book, have talked about the duty to warn, and this gets into this whole controversy over the Goldwater Rule, which goes back to actually the 1970s when Barry Goldwater was pretty much characterized in Fact magazine, in the old Ralph Ginsberg magazine, as being mentally ill, and some of it had to do with intimations of homosexuality, which is pretty egregious when we think about it in our own present time. But there's a lot of fire that has been cast on this notion that psychiatrists can and indeed should make diagnoses of anyone that they're not treating and make them public.
Right. Well, my view of that, and that of many people involved in the duty to warn movement, is that part of the Goldwater Rule is okay. That is, one should not make a formal professional diagnosis without a hands-on examination. But what we're doing, certainly what I'm doing, and what most of the people who wrote chapters in the book are doing, is to talk about psychological tendencies and psychological aberrations without necessarily making a diagnosis. And of course, these can be made with the help of actions that Trump has carried through, statements that he's made. And we feel we'd be remiss if we didn't point these out. So that's adhering to the Goldwater Rule in terms of a formal diagnosis, but not allowing ourselves to be gagged and forbidden from saying anything that we know about his psychological disturbances that are harmful to the country and to the world.
We're talking to Robert Lifton. He's now a lecturer in psychiatry at Columbia University, author of many books, and also has written about and been very involved in the effects of war and terrorism and genocide. His most recent book is The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival. And I have to ask you, Professor Lifton, about the whole idea of normalization. We go back to some of the work you've done, which is pioneer and breakthrough work in those who were involved, for example, in overseeing torture, psychologists who were condemned for overseeing torture, working with actually those in the Nazi regime as you did, and this is not to make analogies there, but I wanted to bring it even closer to the present because there was a Cold War commission to kind of help Americans accept the idea of nuclear normality and stockpiling nuclear weapons. And I think what this duty to warn is getting at, especially with the idea of Donald Trump having his hands on the nuclear code, is that there's a normalization of much of whatever this malignancies or these malignancies are that we attribute to President Trump.
Yes, exactly. I emphasized in my foreword what I call malignant normality, something that's presented to us as normal. And I've, in the past, done a lot of work on nuclear weapons and tried to expose the idea of not only stockpiling, but using them, fighting and winning and recovering from a nuclear war, being part of the rhetoric and part of what was considered normal in relation to nuclear weapons, when actually that was a malignant and dangerous version of normality. And with Trump in our present situation, when a man is elected president, whatever he does seems to normalize things because he's in that high office. But as you know, Trump does egregious things which are harmful, and it's our task, I think, as what I call witnessing professionals, to expose that claim to normality as highly dangerous. And of course, it isn't only Trump. We've had, as you mentioned, psychologists who have been architects of torture, and that was held to be what they were supposed to do and paid for doing, another example of malignant normality. And I came to it from studying Nazi doctors whose normal behavior in Auschwitz was to conduct selections that sent Jews to the gas chambers. Now, I'm not calling anybody a Nazi at all. I'm just saying that this is a pattern of malignant normality that can occur when a president like Trump does deeply harmful things and becomes an inveterate liar.
And another example you use is those Vietnam soldiers who wanted to dissent from the war and were thought to be perhaps psychologically disturbed and needed to be brought back to the fighting of the war. One last question, Professor Lifton, before I let you go here, and that is the American Psychiatric Association said in a statement that the duty to warn does not apply if there is no physician-patient relationship.
Well, it's a general concept, a kind of metaphor. Of course, we are not the physicians or therapists to the whole country. So we don't have a physician-patient relationship. But the duty to warn is a concept that we seize upon because we can view and understand patterns that everybody, in a sense, is affected by. When we indicate that Trump has psychological difficulties, that's no surprise to anyone. We can give it a certain kind of credibility and precision, and that we consider a duty to warn in the broadest sense. And I feel that that's a very reasonable approach. In fact, I think we would be remiss and we would be avoiding our ethical responsibility if we fail to do so.
Robert Lifton, good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Robert Lifton, again, lecturer in psychiatry at Columbia and author of over 20 books. And he is a contributor to the book we're talking about here and the whole question of Donald Trump's mental stability or mental health, duty to warn. Tom Singer is here in studio with us. And Tom Singer is a psychiatrist, a Jungian analyst for 20 years, a medical expert in the Social Security Administration hearings and appeals department, where he reviewed disability claim appeals. His latest book is Europe's Many Souls, about the cultural complexes and identities of nations. And good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Good morning, Tom Singer.
Good morning.
And I should mention a contributor to A Dangerous Case, the book that we're talking about here. And that book really kind of lays it out. I mean, it lays it out not only in terms of a duty and an obligation to warn, but also not only intimates, but pretty much comes across with the fact that Donald Trump is not fit to be the president. Let me go right to the chase here, though, because you've got a study that was done, I know you're familiar with, back in 1974, that said half of the United States presidents are not mentally equipped or stable by at least psychiatric rules. Lincoln was terribly depressed, maybe our best president, you know, and there are presidents who probably had serious anxiety neuroses and bipolar problems and so forth. Why this president?
I think the issue that the book points to that would differentiate Trump's...
Let me mention the title of the book again.
Sure.
The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump.
The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. The issue that the book, I think, focuses on is the question of dangerousness. There are many people who function quite well most of the time, who have various kinds of mental difficulties or diagnosable mental illnesses, who are able to function, and more importantly, they're not dangerous to other people. And I think
probably the majority of people with psychiatric problems are not
necessarily
dangerous
to other people. So yeah. That's the point of distinction between Trump and other previous presidents who have been thought to have mental illness. You know, actually, there are three things I want to say in response to Dr. Lifton, which may continue his points, which I think are excellent, because my focus has been less on Trump as an individual and his individual psychopathology, which includes, I think, issues of narcissism and sociopathy and probably attention deficit disorder as well.
Forgive me, the book makes a textbook case for particularly narcissism.
it does make a textbook case. And if I read the criteria for narcissistic disorders, he has every one on the list. So I think the book makes a strong argument that he has at least narcissistic traits. But Dr. Lifton spoke about three things. He talked about malignant normality or normalcy, Trump having that. And his tweets are a perfect example of that, where every day he sends out something that's divisive and disturbing. And that's become normal. That's a kind of it's not like training Nazi doctors to sadistically abuse people, but it's introducing something that's actually quite abnormal in terms of stirring up the psyche of the collective, if you will. That's a kind of malignant normalcy.
Not only with tweets, there are some who argue, and I think Dr. Lifton has argued this, that there's a normalization of climate change not necessarily being tied to extinction or not necessarily the danger that it is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the reasons I feel it's imperative, the need to warn, the duty to warn, is there's a way in which it feels as though Trump is leading us headlong towards extinction, both in terms of climate change and also potentially nuclear disaster. He's really leading the charge to extinction in some ways. That's the way it at least feels, and it's terrifying.
But nobody's saying that if you're a non-believer in climate change, you're clinically to be concerned about, or that if you deny climate change, you're clinically crazy or something
no,
along those lines.
No, not at all. Another point that he made about Trump and his relationship to reality, or his lack of relationship to reality, which is equally disturbing, is that it suggests that the many people in our culture have lost a kind of relationship to reality. That's a point that Christopher Hedges makes in his book. He calls it the empire of illusion, the end of literacy and the triumph of spectacle. And I think what he's suggesting is, as a culture, we have lost our relationship to reality, or many of us, and so reality TV becomes our reality, which in fact is a fiction.
And the idea that you are working with, and I should say Thomas Singer is a contributor to the new book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, is that not only are things being normalized, but that in some ways Trump is reflecting a kind of national wound of sorts, or a national consciousness.
I think that what really interests me is how Trump's what you could call megalomania, which comes from the Greek, which megalo means big and mania means possession by or fanatic sort of pursuit of, his fanatic pursuit of being big, his megalomania. To me, there's a perfect fit between that, or what we call grandiosity, and what I think is the injured narcissism of many Americans who feel quite threatened by the very rapid changes in communication, distribution of wealth, loss of jobs. There are a whole lot of reasons for many people to be frightened in our country. And Trump sort of promises a kind of antidote or even cure for that sense of narcissistic injury at the group level.
There's also been a word that's thrown out a lot about President Trump, and it's in this book, sociopathic. Are we talking about perhaps not only a narcissistic culture, thinking about books that have, Christopher Lash's book particularly about American narcissism,
yes,
but some kind of sociopathic element in this, or dimension to American, I mean, you're a Jungian, so you have all this collective consciousness involved in this, the shadow and all the rest of it.
Well, you know, Trump's appeal to...
laughing, but serious stuff we're talking about.
It is serious stuff. Well, I think there is a sociopathic element, because sociopathy, what makes his narcissism malignant in my mind, is that sociopaths don't have a conscience. There's no shame in what they do. They're very good at intuiting what other people need or don't need and playing on that, but without any capacity for empathy. So the lack of empathy, the absence of guilt, and the incredible ability to manipulate other people, those are all sociopathic traits.
And when I said textbook narcissist, the textbook narcissism has to do not only with lack of empathy, but with someone who can be very charismatic, male or female, without conscience and the rest of that. And there have been all of these ideas that have been put forward about essentially mental instability, about someone who is and by the way, clinical narcissism is incurable in many cases, isn't it?
Well, if the question is, what can we expect from Trump in terms of his ability to change his character, I don't think we can expect anything. I don't think his narcissism is touchable. I think he'd have to melt into a puddle of something before one would even get to what he suffers inside. But his genius, he has a genius. I think his genius, particularly at the beginning of the election, was his ability to sense tremendous distress in a number of people. And he used the trigger word political correctness. And he understood that there were a large number of people who were profoundly unhappy, enraged, and particularly enraged at the idea that they had to be compassionate, inclusive, multicultural. When they saw themselves threatened, this kind of political correctness, the need to be compassionate, he understood there were a lot of people who had very strong feelings against that.
A genius of being attuned to what's in the culture of the zeitgeist or in many people's minds, frames of mind, yeah?
Yes, and somewhat beneath the level of everyday consciousness, he tapped into deep-seated resentments that people were not free to express until he came along.
I'm interested, though, in you're talking about and writing about in the book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, the effect this has on the body politic and so forth, on the national consciousness. We had Van Jones on yesterday, and he was characterizing President Trump as ADD, you know, having a tweet all the time and all the rest of that sort of thing, and saying that some of that can be infectious. I think this is what you're saying, isn't it?
I think that what disturbs me most about Trump on the day-to-day is that his very agitated psyche, which is filled with petty resentments and hostilities and the need for revenge and bullying, is infecting the national psyche. I think it agitates everybody. And it's profoundly disturbing because we identify with our president either positively or negatively. They live inside of us. The president lives inside of us. And either we believe him and we adore him or we hate him. But he is very disturbing.
He can be a catalyst of bad behavior, even to those who loathe him and who feel enmity toward him. I mean, did they internalize him in a sense? Is that what you're saying?
I will speak for myself. I internalize him as a very negative figure who evokes enormous sense of powerlessness and frustration and even rage. Yes, I think he infects all of us, whether we're for him or against him.
Well, it's not only psychiatrists, by the way. I just wanted to bring this into the discussion, then invite listeners to join us. During the Republican primaries, Marco Rubio suggested that President Trump was a lunatic. Rand Paul dubbed him a delusional narcissist, and Ted Cruz denounced him as utterly amoral and a narcissist at a level I don't think the country's ever seen. Mitt Romney opined, his is not the temperament of a stable, thoughtful leader, and Jeb Bush declared he needs therapy. In recent months, Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, has admitted she is worried about the president's mental health, and Senator Bob Corker, Republican of Tennessee, has warned that Trump, quote, has not yet been able to demonstrate the stability nor some of the competence necessary for a successful presidency. So we get into a lot of issues here with the concern about the president and his shall we say, mental stability, especially those hands on the nuclear code. The book is called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. 27 psychiatrists and mental health experts assess a president, and we do invite you to join the program. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Join us now at that number, 866-733-6786, or email forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us, Twitter handles @kqedforum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the ethics of assessing President Trump's mental state. And in fact, I'm noticing a comment on Facebook from someone critical of this saying, what are the ethics of a broadcasting organization like KQED putting out these trashy stories? I'm not sure that that characterization is apt. In fact, I would argue against that characterization. But we're trying to really also talk about the ethics of questioning the president's mental health or going on record with them. And I thought we'd bring Samuel Berendez into this discussion. He's professor emeritus of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, author of a number of other books, Making Sense of People, The Science of Personality Differences. And good to have you with us, Professor Berendez.
Thank you, Michael.
Let's begin by talking about the Goldwater Rule, because I think you're not on the same page as many of those who have put together The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. It's something that you cherish and hold fast to the idea that psychiatrists shouldn't come out publicly and make these kind of diagnoses?
Well, yes. Let me explain my position, which actually has evolved in the course of this particular debate and reading the dangerous case of Donald Trump. I remember the Fact magazine, I'm old enough to remember it, where some hundreds or thousands of members of the American Psychiatric Association published a manifesto declaring Barry Goldwater unfit to be president. And at the time, that seemed to me to be a breach of psychiatric ethics, and indeed, the American Psychiatric Association concluded that that was so, and it went up to the Supreme Court, and basically, although there was some dissent, the notion that psychiatrists could, in their professional capacity, make diagnoses without physically or personally dealing with a person, and also announce this publicly, was considered unethical. Since then, a great deal has been learned about behavioral differences, personality differences, and a great deal has been learned about them by observing public figures like presidents of the United States, who we see, in the case of Donald Trump, hourly on CNN, in his tweets, etc., and where it's clear that it's not hard to come to some pretty clear conclusions about critical behavioral patterns that he has. Whether to call them disorders, personality disorders, or personality spectral changes, that is, personality differences, one can debate. I don't think the word disorders has a proper place in this conversation.
Well, excuse me, but personality is a different way or a different, shall we say, medium of looking at this as opposed to opening up the psychiatric disorder book, isn't it?
Well, but yes, so the psychiatric, that's a very good point. The psychiatric book actually struggles with that. They classify personality disorders as separate from disorders like depression, manic depression, etc. It's a separate category, and initially they were classified categorically. That is, there were a bunch of symptoms, and if you went over the edge, you had a disorder. If you had them in a milder form, you didn't have the disorder. But it gradually became clear that it's all on a spectrum. I mean, all of us have a little bit of narcissism. Maybe not all of us, but many of us. And it actually can be quite productive. All of us have a little bit of compulsiveness, and if it's not in the extreme, it can be very productive. So that there are these potentially troublesome patterns of behavior which are widely distributed and are part of normal personality construction. So it's when it comes to disorder and to labeling somebody as a psychiatric patient, which in the minds of many people in the public might include lock him up, that the problem really emerges. And in the Goldwater case, there was even some view, not about locking him up, but about saying this guy was sick in a categorical way, whereas I think that the previous speakers don't believe that, nor do I. I think he's on a dimension, but it's a malignant dimension. It's a troublesome dimension.
But so, is this a misapplication, really, of the duty to warn, then, that came out of the whole Goldwater case in your judgment?
Well, yes. So that's exactly what this whole discussion brings up. And I have been persuaded. When I first heard about the conference that gave rise to this book at Yale, I was worried that a manifesto would come out with a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, stuff like that. I had no idea what it was going to lead to. That's not what happened. What happened is a very thoughtful assessment based on lots of public data, which I think gives us a very clear way of thinking about terrific vulnerabilities on the part of our current president, which one can say elicits a duty to warn.
But forgive me, I just have to break in here because we got a lot of people who want to weigh in and have a say. But bottom line for you is maybe these are treacherous waters to be navigating?
Yes, let me just sum it up. They're treacherous in terms of this guy should be put in a mental institution. But I think that mental health professionals are no less entitled as individuals to publish papers and write reports.
First Amendment citizen rights, huh?
Right. So just as journalists can, just as ethicists can, just as political scientists can, just as historians can, I think mental health professionals are not disqualified from making these kinds of judgments.
Well, I thank Samuel Berendes again, who joined us by phone. He's professor emeritus of psychiatry at UC San Francisco and author of, among other books, Making Sense of People, The Science of Personality Differences. Thank you, Dr. Berendes.
Thank you very much, Michael.
And we are going to stay with this with Thomas Singer, who's here with us in studio, and take your calls. And we go to Dawn first in La Honda. Dawn, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I've read the book, and it's fantastic. And one of the most compelling arguments, I think, within the book was the historical case of President Carter receiving a warning, basically saying that the USSR was sending a bunch of nuclear weapons our way. And thank God he had the peace of mind to first ask that that be verified. Then it turned out that it said there were even more coming our way. And then, as I remember you saying in the book, he asked to get on the phone with the USSR and indeed make sure that that was true, and it turned out to be a computer glitch. Now, when I heard that story, I thought Trump does not have the peace of mind, the impulse control to think something like that through. And that, if with Trump at the helm, that would be the beginning of World War III.
Well, thank you, Dawn. And mention of President Carter brings to mind, I don't know if listeners are aware of this, but he's come out recently and said what I would characterize as some fairly encouraging remarks about President Trump in terms of, will President Trump enable me to be a diplomat and go to North Korea as I did when Kim Jong-un, the father of Kim Jong-il, was in charge? And he sounded like he was really trying to temper his remarks a great deal about President Trump. Wondering, though, getting back to the – we'll get to some more callers here, but Tom Singer, getting back to the book – Bandy Lee put this book together, or this whole conference together at Yale, and she describes herself as a pariah in her own department at Yale.
Yes, I think that she was greeted with the skepticism that Dr. Berendes mentioned that he had about a conference like this, that it was going to be a repeat of the Goldwater fiasco, and the profession has its conservative element, and they were very afraid that this was going to provoke a lot of negative reaction within the profession, and the university distanced itself from it because people were concerned about fundraising or so on. So she was very isolated in promoting this and very courageous. I think only 15 people showed up. People were afraid.
And we should mention that there are not only psychiatrists in the book, there are articles by Gail Sheehy, and there's an article by Tony Schwartz, who actually wrote the book of the Art of the Deal, and some remarks by Noam Chomsky. Let me get some more callers on her, though. Let me get to Anthony. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, Michael. Thank you for taking my call. Great conversation. Yeah, one thing I always like to try to mention to people is that this is the madman theory in work right now. I mean, this is what Henry Kissinger wanted to do with Richard Nixon and his craziness back in the 60s. So, I mean, I don't understand why we can't see these correlations here and what's going on. And I think the biggest problem is why he even got into power was because of the media. The media just fed into all this craziness and didn't even step up to say, where's the moral and ethics of this person? This person is not fit to be president. But we gave him $5 billion of free press, and he got elected. So now we're dealing with the madman in the White House, where, again, he is all over the place. You can't put a thumb on him. He's here. He's there. He's tweeting this. He's tweeting that. I mean, this is what the elites want out of a president. So we can't keep tabs on him because there's so many things that he is making us angry about. thoughts.
I thank you for those remarks, Anthony. In fact, you mentioned Kissinger. There was certainly a sense that Kissinger was Dr. Strangelove or something along those lines, that he would lead us into nuclear war, but particularly Nixon. And there's happened to be talking recently to Daniel Ellsberg about this, and he reminded me that James Schlesinger, who was at the time the Secretary of Defense, actually said, don't go ahead with any kind of nuclear orders from President Nixon until you have the clearance of me as Secretary of Defense. I don't know if we could expect the same thing out of the present Secretary of Defense, Mattis, but the reality is that we've been here before to some extent, haven't we?
Yeah, this story is told in the book. It's told really quite beautifully. Apparently, Nixon was drinking very heavily, and he was wandering around the halls of the White House talking to the portraits of the previous presidents. And the concern was that he was so paranoid and so enraged that he might sort of as a personal gesture set off a thermonuclear war. So they actually took that capacity out of his hands kind of quietly behind his back. One only hopes that the same thing has been done in today's White House.
And I'm going to read some comments here. I sense a problematic, Michael writes, use of the term duty to warn. Would the authors consider emphasizing that they are exercising their civic responsibilities as citizens rather than medical responsibilities as physicians?
I think that's a really good point. I think the duty to warn comes from trying to offset the Goldwater rule, which protects the confidentiality of the patient. So then you go to the Tarasoff rule, which says that a physician has the responsibility to warn somebody else if they're endangered. So they're sort of extrapolating that. We have extrapolated that from duty to warn. But I think it's maybe a better way, rather than trying to get around the Goldwater rule by evoking the duty to warn, simply say, as citizens, we need to speak out. I agree with that comment.
Because there are many psychiatrists who disagree. And by representing psychiatrists, in a sense, or at least the implicit sense of representing psychiatrists, you don't represent those who strongly disagree. Karen, in fact, there was a psychiatrist who I read who gave an account of Trump's mental health and said, not only is he a genius, as you characterized him, but look at how successful he's been. He's got a lovely family. You know, he's had a few marriages, but nevertheless, he's got children who seem devoted to him and they seem loving toward him as a father and all the rest of that. And so who could ask for anything more in terms of stability and normality? This was the argument of a psychiatrist who obviously some would see as being on. How do you respond to that, Tom?
Well, I think there are probably many people who see him as the incarnation of the American dream. He's rich, he's powerful, he's able to say what he wants, he can carry on, and he gets away with it. So depending on your political point of view, you could see him as the incarnation of what makes America great. I don't happen to see him that way. The problem in all of this is when you politicize psychiatric language, and I think that's why Dr. Barandas and others are very concerned about the Goldwater rule. How do psychiatrists speak out with what we know our expertise is without sounding like we're just partisan? Is there a way to both present our point of view objectively to some extent and be good citizens? And so there are going to be arguments on both sides.
And Dr. Brundis used to be head of Langley Porter here in San Francisco, and there was always a schism, you know, between those who wanted to think of psychiatry as a hard science, look at the genes, look at the neurons, and those who were characterized kind of as a lay down on the couch type of psychiatrist. I mean, there is a divide there. There is a major chasm there. And in fact, I've got a comment here from Karen who says, as a psychoanalyst from the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California, fellow colleagues and I have authored a statement of concern by mental health practitioners documenting significantly increased levels of fear, rage, anxiety, and vulnerability in a number of our clients since Trump's inauguration. Clients have suffered greater anxiety disorders. That goes right to your thesis, Thomas Singer. But should presidents be vetted? Should, for that matter, major public officials of any kind be vetted psychiatrically when it's not a hard science?
It's a really interesting question because actually just about everybody else in high levels of authority, particularly in the military, are vetted. They go through extensive psychological and medical testing. And actually the only person at that high level, as I understand it, who doesn't undergo that is the President of the United States. I think there's a good argument.
Well, I don't know if Supreme Court justices do.
Well, it may not be true. I think it's problematic. How would you implement the testing and who would be doing the testing? But I think it's worth considering.
And here's Tom from Oakland. Tom, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. While I consider myself one out of millions of voters who are definitely for impeachment and a quick removal of this president, it does give me pause to hear the flipping of the thinking process whereby we give so much credence to the personality disorder as if the sole personality disorder is going to infect the nation, when what personality disorder has not existed that was given rise to by the social hummus that pre-existed it. And, of course, Trump is full of personal disorders, but who isn't, especially during rush hour on the freeway? This antisocial behavior, it's endemic, the bullying in school. But what I appreciate with Trump is that he kind of put this syndrome on boosters, where he has accelerated the ongoing immigrant deportations to the hilt, the nuclear issue he has brought to the hilt. And I remember one interview with Leslie Stahl where she said, you know, Putin is a killer. And he goes, and we're not. I mean, the Iraq war has been forgotten, basically. Crime fit to be tried at The Hague. And we talk about personality disorder. The body count has not started yet with Trump, but there's plenty of bodies on the trail throughout our history.
Well, Tom, I thank you for that call. And again, he's saying somewhat of what you say. You know, Trump is maybe a lot of Americans on steroids or something like that. That he reflects us, that he basically
reflects. I think he does reflect our more negative qualities, if you will. I think he reflects our violence, our problems with controlling our impulses, our belief that we're entitled to everything as a country. We have a history of exceptionalism. In my opinion, he speaks for some of the worst attributes of what America stands for in the world.
Well, Matthew writes, news about Harvey Weinstein has revealed that he and Trump seem to share some behaviors and attitudes. Laura wants to know, does the book examine the hypothesis that in addition to mental illness, Trump may also have dementia? Indeed, it does.
Yeah, there's a very cautious article by a neurologist who goes through a very traditional kind of thought process and lays out sort of pluses and minuses. There is consideration given, and I think the conclusion is quite equivocal. I don't think there's any statement that there's any evidence that he suffers from a dementia.
Well, years ago, Helen Caldicott, an anti-nuclear activist and physician from Australia, told me that she had met with Reagan in the last part of his second term and was convinced then that he had Alzheimer's. And now we know from Ron Reagan Jr. that that was probably indeed the case. So again, you know, this problem of evaluating and of making a diagnosis is one that you know, is fraught with all kinds of difficulties, isn't it?
Yes, the Dee Mosbacher and Bandy Lee, two of the primary contributors to the book, make an argument under the 25th Amendment to the Constitution about the need to evaluate or the right to evaluate a president if there's concern about health and disability. And under that 25th Amendment, they're arguing that there should be institutionalized some form of regular evaluation.
And we'll bring more of our callers into the discussion here. Let me go next to you, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
As disturbed as I am about Trump, I'm more disturbed by the political process that doesn't call him to task. Each of the Republicans who support him must go through some kind of cognitive dissonance, whereas they understand that he's nuts, but yet at the same time he enables their agenda. And I'd like the professor to discuss the psychology of the representatives as much as this is psychology of Trump himself.
Well, those enablers in the Republican Party, or for that matter, just any enablers in the political world. I mean, you've got people like Bob Corker now speaking out against President Trump, but many either won't or choose not to. A lot of it has to do with politics and concern about being reelected. But how else do you read that, Tom Singer?
Well, I agree with the caller that it is profoundly disturbing that apparently quietly many people in Congress are deeply concerned, but they're not coming forward. I attribute at least part of that to what an incredible bully Trump is and how he can single people out for unbelievable negative treatment in the press. Corker, of course, is retiring, so he's free to speak out. But I imagine any incumbent who's running for re-election is terrified that Trump will turn against him. I think it's sheer fear. I had fear about coming out against Trump as a psychiatrist that somehow there would be retaliation. I think he's an incredible bully and in that sense a tyrant who terrorizes the population.
I know, in fact, when Art of the Deal came out, and I'm not going to name any names, but there were book dealers and booksellers who were really bullied by him back then. He wanted to make sure that the book was pretty much highlighted in ways that he felt it should be, and that's a whole other story. But let me bring some more callers into here, and let's go to Sacramento. David, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a couple of points. One, I'm a little bit concerned at the idea of long-distance analysis, and I understand that there are exigent circumstances. And while I think Trump is completely unqualified for a job and really shouldn't be there, that speaks more to a problem with the body politic. And my last point is, don't a lot of captains of industry exhibit traits of psychopaths? I think it's kind of more of a normative thing than anything else, and maybe it's a qualification for the job.
Yeah, thank you for that, David. Let me go to Thomas Singer here.
Well, one certainly reads that very bright sociopaths tend to do very well in the business world, and I've heard that mentioned several times. I mean, I think there's probably truth to that, although I don't think they get to that position often by being so impulsive and unpredictable. And I think it's the impulsiveness and unpredictability, I would imagine, have eliminated Trump from most major corporations except one that he owns and controls himself.
A couple of comments about Trump supporters. David writes, the fact that this man cannot discriminate between fact and fiction makes him a threat. His supporters can't see this. The divide will never close until he's gone. And Bruce writes, progressives have now been cautioned repeatedly to be sensitive to the attitudes and culture of Trump supporters. So have the co-authors discussed how the book is not going to be read by Trump supporters and how the existence of the book will exacerbate attacks on science and the science of psychology and psychiatry in particular? That's been thought through and discussed? I don't know if you can speak for the editor and all the contributors here.
I really can't speak for other people. I have thought, actually, my last sentence in my chapter is that I hope in the issue of considering narcissism, those of us who are more to the left or certainly Democrats will understand our own capacity to be narcissistic and self-righteous in our own beliefs about Trump. And so there's an attempt to bring some of that back to ourselves. I think it's a good point. I don't think one can write a book today that's going to speak to both those who favor Trump and those who are violently against him. I don't think that's a bridgeable gap right now.
Again, Thomas Singer is a psychiatrist and Jungian analyst and a contributor to the book The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. And let me bring another caller aboard here, and that's Susan in Marin County. Susan, welcome.
Hello. I have a statement and a question. My statement is to question the idea that because he has a family, he must be mentally fit somehow. First of all, he's been married 3 times. And during the Access Hollywood case, we saw that he was married to Melania when the activity that was reflected was going on. Second is my question. I'd like the psychiatrist to answer whether he thinks Trump is also borderline, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. And by the way, we did a whole forum hour on borderline personalities. It's in our archives, and it was a fascinating hour. But Thomas Singer?
That's a really interesting question, and I certainly don't have a definitive answer to that. It has occurred to me in one context. Sometimes some people with borderline features have the capacity to get inside of one and stir things up in a way that other people can't. In psychiatry, we call that a projective identification. There's a very powerful thing that goes on with borderline people sometimes. And sometimes I think Trump has the capacity to get inside of us and stir things up in a profoundly disturbing way that has a borderline quality.
Which brings us right to a final question for you in the time remaining. Tricia wants to know, how do we survive emotionally and psychologically when we are being, she describes it, terrorized daily by Trump? What can we do to stabilize ourselves emotionally so we can cope?
Well, I can only respond to the caller with what I've done, which is I spent the last six months researching and writing a paper on folly from Plato through Erasmus to the current day. What we're experiencing is so full of what has been called folly and farce that sometimes I find some distance by just thinking the human folly is amazing.
That's a good way to distance yourself from it. Thank you, Thomas Singer. Good to have you here on Forum, and good to have Robert Lifton and Samuel Berendez, and you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday, and for you, by the way, every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And I would encourage you, those of you who are listening, who want to continue this discussion, that you can do so online simply by going to kqed.org/forum. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll be back tomorrow talking in this hour about Leonardo da Vinci. A new biography is out by that great biographer, Walter Isaacson, and hope you will join us for that. Thank you for joining us for this and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.